For Memorial Day, New World Notes rebroadcasts our strongest anti-war program to date. It's from May 2009, and I think just as cogent today as it was then. Thank you for listening. Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The Slippery Slope of Memorial Day. Today we'll take on Memorial Day and wrestle it to the ground. I'll rip a patriotic poem to shreds. Robert Fisk will talk about war. After a Canadian anti-war song, I'll read Howard Zinn's essay on Memorial Day, the one that got him fired from the Boston Globe. So, fire up the grill, uncap a returnable glass bottle of some fizzy liquid, and turn up the radio. It's Memorial Day 2009, or pretty close. And if I had any sense, I'd add, may God rest the dead and forgive the living, and spend the next 26 minutes talking about organic farming, or maybe the assassination of William McKinley. But I've got to wade waist-deep in the big muddy, because Memorial Day brings together too many important themes of this program. Themes like the abuse, degradation, and destruction of our soldiers by our chicken hawk patriots with American flag pins on their lapels. Especially those chicken hawk patriots that stand to make a buck out of whichever war we're killing our young people with at the moment. Memorial Day is the occasion to make senseless bloodbaths that destroy soldiers and civilians alike, that enrich only the most vicious of the already rich, that violate almost every ethical and moral precept that parents and priests and school teachers teach their children. This infernal butchery is now passed off as noble and holy. Docet et decorum est pro patria mori, etc., etc. As I said, and in English, the sensible fellow wouldn't bring up any of this, especially in a patriotistic week such as this one. And if patriotistic isn't a word, it darn well ought to be. Here's a phrase, rote learned, that said a lot on Memorial Day. He gave his life to defend his country. Wrong on two counts. First, he didn't willingly give his life, they took it. Second, at the very least for the past 60 years, he wasn't defending his country. He was defending the profits of transnational corporations that don't give a damn about his country and ours. That's why their new factories are in Kuala Lumpur, and they pay their corporate taxes to the Cayman Islands. When the soldier was killed invading Panama in 1989, was he defending the homeland against the Panamanians? When she was killed in Afghanistan, did she give her life in order to defend America against Afghani invaders arriving in transport ships? How about Iraq? As Cindy Sheehan famously asked, what was the noble cause for which her son was sacrificed, along now with 4,500 other sons and daughters? How about Grenada, 1983? Does anyone even remember the official pretext for sending troops marching into Grenada? Can anyone even find Grenada on a map? Memorial Day is perched on a slippery slope. We show our respect for the dead, for Americans who obeyed orders they couldn't refuse and were killed. That is worthy. Then we slide down the slope to honoring the bloody, aggressive state policies that caused the deaths. Honor these policies by intentionally confusing them with defending our country. That is unworthy. Then we slide down further and turn the memorial into propaganda, supporting whatever bloody aggression the ruling elite are conducting at the moment. and propaganda for ever higher public expenditures to make future acts of bloody aggression even more profitable for the ruling elite. This is obscene. Then we slide to the very bottom and proclaim that we must commit ever larger acts of bloody aggression. To fail to do so would be to dishonor the military debt of the past. This is beyond obscene. This is blasphemy. So on Memorial Day, we turn slaughter into sacrifice, into sacrilege. You'll recall that at one point, the only public reason to continue occupying Iraq that Bush could come up with was this: if we give Iraq back to the Iraqis, or cut and run, as he put it, if we fail to stay the course, this would dishonor the 2,500 American soldiers who were killed in Iraq to that time. Okay, now we've killed nearly twice as many. Can we go home now? Or would that dishonor the nearly 5,000 Americans killed in Iraq to date? Surely the best way to honor them is to stay the course until we've killed 5,000 more, right? In a minute, we'll hear journalist Robert Fisk and his thoughts on war. But first, a little poem. It's only 15 lines, divided into three short stanzas. It's the most famous Memorial Day poem in the world. It was written by a Canadian military officer, John McCrae, in his notebook in May 1915 in the Flanders region of Belgium, the day after a friend had been killed in battle. Here's what I admire about McCrae. Later, he reread the poem, ripped it out of his notebook, presumably crumpled it up, and discarded it. Unfortunately, another officer retrieved the page and mailed it to England to be published in the popular magazine Punch. I like to think that McCrae chucked the poem because he realized that the third stanza falsified the truth about warfare and so dishonored his late friend and comrade. Literary scholar Paul Fussell wrote that, in describing the third stanza, quote, "words like vicious and stupid would not seem to go too far," unquote. For here, the dead soldiers are calling out from their graves, essentially, "stay the course, for cutting and running would dishonor us." World War I continued for another 3.5 years after the poem was written. In the end, 20 million soldiers died in that war, including McCrae himself. For what noble cause? In this poem, we see the whole slippery slope of Memorial Day. The poem starts out as a nice little elegy, expressing respect and sadness for the dead soldiers, now buried in Flanders Fields. That's the title, of course. The poem ends in bathos, propaganda, and jingoism. Here it is, then on to Robert Fisk. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields. Here's Robert Fisk.
You know, over and over again, and journalists forget this, we constantly, when we want to go to war, we evoke World War II. Always. At the time of the Suez Crisis in 1956, Anthony Eden, British Prime Minister, called Nasser the Mussolini of the Nile. And of course, when we wanted to go to war in Iraq, well, not us, but they wanted to go to war in Iraq, Saddam became the Hitler of the Tigris River, the Hitler of Baghdad, and we were all entitled to become Winston Churchill. And anyone who objected to the war, they were an appeaser, like Neville Chamberlain. You know the story, the way it goes. And therefore, of course, we can then justify war. Not as the reality of war actually is, which is the total failure of the human spirit. It's about death, not about primarily victory or defeat, but as a policy option. You see, that's how we get the permission. The Archbishop of Canterbury, poor soul, actually said that the 1991 Gulf War was a just war. And if you saw what I see on battlefields in the Middle East, at massacres, bodies torn apart, the famous highway of death, there were actually two highways of death, north of Kuwait in 1991, where the British as well as the American Air Force had bombed and bombed and bombed, not just the military, but refugee cars as well. And there in the desert were men, some of them soldiers, some not, women and children, being torn apart, dead, by dogs. It was lunchtime. And bits of them, arms, fingers, being taken off to be eaten in the desert. You don't see that. If you saw what I see on battlefields, you would never, ever support a war or talk about just wars. But I've been over and over again confronted, particularly in British Commonwealth countries, by the argument, but don't you think World War II was just? And since my father, who was much older than my mum, fought in the First World War and has signed up to be the resistance leader in southern England after the German invasion, which of course mercifully never came because he would have been executed as a terrorist, no doubt, I think, yes, my father was right to be prepared to fight for England. Yes, the Royal Air Force was right to fight the Battle of Britain. But the World War II is finished. You know, when Menachem Begin was sending the Israeli army up to Beirut in 1982, he wrote this crazed letter to President Ronald Reagan saying he felt as if he was advancing on Berlin with Hitler in his bunker, Hitler being the pathetic and corrupt Arafat. And, you know, there was a very good piece written by Uri Avneri, a very brave Israeli journalist whom most of you will know of. He wrote an open letter to Menachem Begin, who of course then was the Israeli Prime Minister, and it began, "Dear Mr. Prime Minister, Hitler is dead." And I feel more and more we need to have a cut-off line after World War II. You know, after the Second World War, we introduced legislation and human rights codes and regulations to prevent World War III. We had new protocols of the International Red Cross, part of which was founded on the Hague Convention, which was before the First World War. We had the UN, the General Assembly, the Security Council. The European Union was founded as a coal and trade organization between Germany and France to prevent another Battle of the Verdun, World War I, and to prevent another occupation of Paris by the German army. Germany and France would never go to war again, nor would Europe. We'd better forget Bosnia at the moment. But we laid down a forest of laws to protect human rights, to protect us. And they were good laws. And we were right to do what we did. I believe in the UN, despite the fact that it's a friendly old donkey that comes clip-clopping in at the end when we need it. But it's there to be used. And I don't think after World War II, I think it's very hard to find a just war or an excuse for a just war. Korea? At times, at the beginning perhaps. But was Vietnam just? Was Yemen a just war? The British fought in Yemen, the British fight against AOKA in Cyprus, or Mau Mau in Kenya, or in Palestine? Look, was the partition of India a just thing? Was Northern Ireland just? Was the Iran-Iraq war just? 8 years, 1.5 million dead? I watched many of them die. I don't think just war exists anymore. I think, though, we need that cut-off point after World War II. And I think many Arabs whom I talk to say the same thing. They believe the same thing. You know, one of the strange things is that we have this idea that in some way the Arab Muslim world don't know what we know, that they don't have the advantages, of course, of our civilization. I don't think we care about them very much. That's why we don't know how many have died in Iraq. The only time that President Bush was asked how many Iraqis were killed, he gave a hopeless underestimate. He said 30,000. But what he actually said was 30,000 more or less. Well, more or less. Can you imagine if he'd been asked how many American troops had died in Iraq and he said, 4,000 more or less? It would have been scandalous. But it's okay if it's about the Iraqis. We are going to give them democracy. We're going to give Iraq human rights. We've had a surge, which means escalation, by the way, if you're using Vietnam speak. So it's okay. The fact that the casualties have fallen because the Shiites have ethnically cleansed all the Sunnis out of the mixed areas doesn't matter. I mean, how many Iraqis have been killed? 250,000? 500,000? 1,000,000? More? I have no idea. But perhaps, I don't know. And we will never know. And we're not meant to know. And we don't care. You know, there was a CIA officer came up to me with a huge pistol in his belt in the Spanish base near Kufa. This is after the Madrid bombings, but before the Spanish withdrew. And he said, you know, he said, there are dozens of armed men on the streets at night, in the country roads. I said, of course, it's an insurgency. He said, what could we have done to stop this? And I said, well, when you reached Baghdad, you might have pitched a huge tent city for every sick and wounded Iraqi outside Baghdad and give them your help and help the suffering Iraqis and show your love for them. But you didn't do that. I've said this before. I've said it in California before. You know, I think the Arabs would like some of our democracy. After all, they've tolerated all these dictators whom we support and all the torture chambers which we accept and all the police torturers, many of whom have been trained by us. They would like some of our democracy. And I think they'd like some packages of human rights from our supermarket shelves. But the freedom that I am always asked about in Lebanon, where I live, is that the Arabs would like freedom from us. And this we do not intend to give them. Was Iraq about oil? Well, if the Iraqi national product had been asparagus or carrots, the 82nd Airborne would not be in Mosul or Baghdad. Of course it wouldn't.
Here's a song recorded in the Vietnam era that I think still works. It shows an America whose bloody wars of aggression are ordered not by the real America, but by a cabal of the elite, here called the Monster. The singer, supposedly a young peace activist, is appealing to citizens to act in accord with real American values and stop the insane bloodbath we're waging overseas.
Police force is watching the people and the
with Steppenwolf. Historian Howard Zinn wrote a biweekly column for the Boston Globe from 1974 to 1976. This is his last column. They canceled his contract as soon as this one appeared in print. It was written right after the end of the Vietnam War. The title is, Whom Will We Honor Memorial Day? Memorial Day will be celebrated as usual by high-speed collisions of automobiles and bodies strewn on highways and the sound of ambulance sirens throughout the land. It will also be celebrated by the display of flags, the sound of bugles and drums, by parades and speeches and unthinking applause. It will be celebrated by giant corporations, which make guns, bombs, fighter planes, aircraft carriers, and an endless assortment of military junk, and which await the $100 billion in contracts to be approved soon by Congress and the President. Memorial Day will be celebrated, in other words, by the usual betrayal of the dead, by the hypocritical patriotism of the politicians and contractors preparing for more wars, more graves to receive more flowers on future Memorial Days. The memory of the dead deserves a different dedication. To peace, to defiance of governments. There was a young woman in New Hampshire who refused to allow her husband, killed in Vietnam, to be given a military burial. She rejected the hollow ceremony ordered by those who sent him and 50,000 others to their deaths. Her courage should be cherished on Memorial Day. There were the B-52 pilots who refused to fly those last vicious raids of Nixon's and Kissinger's war. Have any of the great universities, so quick to give honorary degrees to God knows whom, thought to honor those men at this commencement time, on this Memorial Day? No politician who voted funds for war, no business contractor for the military, no general who ordered young men into battle, no FBI man who spied on anti-war activities should be invited to public ceremonies on this sacred day. Let the dead of past wars be honored. Let those who live pledge themselves never to embark on mass slaughter again. Quote, the shell had his number on it. The blood ran into the ground. Where his chest ought to have been, they pilled the Congressional Medal, the DSC, the Medaille Militaire, the Belgian Croix de Guerre, the Italian Gold Medal, the Virtutita Militaria sent by Queen Marie of Romania. All of Washingtonians brought flowers. Woodrow Wilson brought a bouquet of poppies. Those are the concluding lines of John Dos Passos' angry novel, 1919. Let us honor him on Memorial Day. And also Thoreau, who went to jail to protest the Mexican War. And Mark Twain, who denounced our war against the Filipinos at the turn of the century. And I.F. Stone, who, virtually alone among newspaper editors, exposed the fraud and brutality of the Korean War. Let us honor Martin Luther King, who refused the enticements of the White House and the cautions of associates, and thundered against the war in Vietnam. Memorial Day should be a day for putting flowers on graves and planting trees. Also for destroying the weapons of death that endanger us more than they protect us, that waste our resources and threaten our children and grandchildren. On Memorial Day, we should take note that, in the name of defense, our taxes have been used to spend $250 million on a helicopter assault ship called the Biggest Floating Lemon, which was accepted by the Navy, though it had over 2,000 major defects at the time of its trial cruise. Meanwhile, there is such a shortage of housing that millions live in dilapidated sections of our cities, and millions more are forced to pay high rents or high interest rates on their mortgages. There's $90 billion for the B-1 bomber, but people don't have money to pay hospital bills. We must be practical, say those whose practicality has consisted of a war every generation. We mustn't deplete our defenses, say those who have depleted our youth, stolen our resources. In the end, it is living people, not corpses, creative energy, not destructive rage, which are our only real defense, not just against other governments trying to kill us, but against our own also trying to kill us. Let us not set out this Memorial Day on the same old drunken ride to death. Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the words by Robert Fisk, our thanks to Mariah Gillardin and TUC Radio. New World Notes is available off the air, by internet stream, podcast, or MP3 download at your convenience. There's an archive of shows you can download, a weekly newsletter, and a blog. All is free. For more information, start at the blog. We're at http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of the presenter, station management staff, or our gracious host and licensee, and they are protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your feedback on this program is most welcome. Email kdowst, that's KDOWST, at hotmail.com. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and reminding you the only sane way to support our troops is to bring them home, every last one of them. Ciao.